So if you can tell us a little bit about your early years, you know, your schooling, your college, and your aspirations and ambitions that led you to where you are today.
Well, firstly, Sanjay, thanks for the introduction, and let me also add that it's nice to be here. I've been interacting with a few of the younger people here. It's very energizing. Seem to be a lot of exciting things going on. And so in terms of my own younger years, as you asked, frankly, I'm very lucky in having had a youth and education by my dad being in the army. I literally grew up around the country. I think some of you who read about me may know that I'd say I've been in 12 schools by the time I was 12 years old. But luckily thereafter, I was able to finish school in one place, and that was in Lucknow. And then went on to do my engineering in Roorkee. And then many years later, an MBA.
Okay. But then in terms of your own goal setting, the aspirations that you had, when would you say those kind of got formed?
Well, I must tell you, and I'm not sure how much that will apply to youth today. I think when you began your career, you had absolutely no idea. I think if we had set dreams for ourselves at that stage, they would have fallen far short of reality. We would have been limited by our dreams because we didn't know that the world was going to evolve like it did. The IT industry as we know it today didn't even exist.
Right.
And I will give you other examples of people who, if they set aspirations, would Narayan Murthy have ever have visualized as he finished college that he would go on to lead India's most respected and admired IT company? Or would Mr. Madhavan and I think that he was going to lead India's first mission to the moon? I think these are things which evolve, and one aspect of setting aspirations is, I think you must have dreams, but you must reset those dreams because you have no idea how far things can evolve for you as you go ahead. Some of the opportunities that you'll see don't even exist today. You can't even think about them. But I'm sure if we had such exciting opportunities which evolved for us in our lifetimes, I think it would be much better for this generation because it's going to get bigger, larger, more expansive. And frankly, the pace of change is not going to slow down. It's going to keep on increasing.
You made an interesting point about having to recalibrate your dreams as one learns and progresses through one's own career and life. And you decided to become an entrepreneur a little later in your own career than, I suppose, a large number of the crowd here.
Some of them straight through
state of college, I suppose.
Some of them seem to be doing it even by themselves.
Exactly. So it would be interesting if you can share with us your own thought process about and the advantages, disadvantages that you see. Between starting off late, early, and all that.
So let's classify entrepreneurs, if you will, into three groups. What I call is early stage, middle stage, who put in, say, maybe at least 7 to 10 years or maybe even 15 years of experience. And then a late stage entrepreneur like myself. And although, of course, when I got in, I was really late stage in the sense I had, at the age of 59, I had about 30 plus years experience. But out of that, you've got to remember that I had begun in IT only in the current field because I was in solid engineering prior to that. So I had 15 plus years of experience in IT. Now let's see what happens for the... let me start with the late stage, which is where I am, and then perhaps explain to you some of the issues which would apply in the other cases. I think one of the biggest advantages of being a late stage entrepreneur is that if you bring a track record and you bring experience, I think you're going to find it easier taking care of the two major things which help you get started. And that is that you'll be building a team because you're able to get people out of the networks that you've had over the years, people who perhaps worked with you in the past. And clearly say all my teams would have come out of a past ecosystem, whether it was when we began Mindtree or now Happiest Minds. And so the team building part as well as getting the people buy into the idea because you've got a track record. And the VCs, community will typically bet on people and then people with a certain track record. It makes it easier and it makes it easier to plan on a larger scale. But then that's also necessary because you're making up for lost time. So you do need to plan on a larger scale. You don't have the luxury of time. So I think these are some of the things which apply to a late stage entrepreneur. Now when I come to the mid stage, and here's a common point between mid and late stage, is I think the people with years of experience, they know certain industries well. They look for new entry strategies, but primarily they will work in areas where they have worked before. So that it may be an extension and say, okay, what's new within that industry? It's not that they're going to embark on something which they really don't know anything about, because What they're bringing to the table is the experience that they have in a given segment which they understand. So it is very largely based on existing knowledge. You could say the mid-stage guys hopefully got more energy and more years ahead in terms of a runway to be able to look at where he wants to take the organization. Now when it comes to the young, people who are going straight into entrepreneurship virtually out of college or after maybe 1 or 2 years in the market, energizing thought I might want to leave behind with you is, if you look at three of the organizations which have probably had the greatest impact on the way things have evolved in high-tech over the years, and I'm not sure if I should call the last company as high-tech, which I'm going to give you the examples of, but the three companies which have formed had this greatest impact, Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, all three of them started by people, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, and now our latest gentleman, Mark Zuckerberg, none of them completed college. So you could say that obviously completion of your college or getting years of experience is not a prerequisite to create the largest. But the danger in that sort of thinking is that for every one of those successes, there must be 100 failures. And so therefore what will happen, I would imagine, with early stage entrepreneurs, two or three things. One is, I think there's much higher likelihood of doing something completely new, because you don't have any experience. Experience in that sense is a problem, because you then just want to be able to do some extensions of the past. Somebody who doesn't have any experience, has got an idea, is probably going to do something radically different, and which has not been done before, and that is why the potential of those ideas is very high. And for contrast, so there's a higher reward, but there's also a higher risk. The other, of course, issue then is that you have to be able to bootstrap, build slowly. If you get funding, it will probably be angel funding, because people are going to hesitate to give you large sums of money unless you, you know, even Google, it took them years, I'm told, before they got their first $1 million check. And the guy who gave them that check, Ram Sriram, probably became as wealthy as the two entrepreneurs behind, because at that stage, the company was valued at such a low level. And concurrent with that, therefore, is the other thought that until you can build valuation in an enterprise, when you go out to raise funds, I think you've got to be clear, can you bootstrap? How long can you do that for, so that you build a certain amount of value before you go out and get the money? Because once you've given away equity, you can't get it back. So a few basic thoughts here.
Sure. And, you know, it's also very interesting, because at different stages, we talked about the early and the mid and the late stage, there are different thought processes that go through the mind of the entrepreneur.
Sure.
When he or she decides to become one.
Mm-hmm.
So what were the kinds of your own drivers mm-hmm. that led you to create Mindtree and now Happiest Minds?
Sure. You know, I'm sure that driver is very different for different people. I'm told that one of the drivers for anybody is supposed to be creation of wealth. And I must say, in all honesty, for myself, that when I was leaving Wipro, for example, I hadn't a clue what was the value of the stock options that I had, or more importantly, the stock options I was walking away from. Because if I was, I'd say, oh my God, I'm going to lose so many crores, how can I take that decision? And yet, by not thinking of it, and yet I must again tell you that at times I suddenly realized, and this is in the Mindtree to Happiest Minds transition, if I had not had that degree of wealth, it would be more difficult to have got started. So yes, maybe wealth should be a bigger objective. And probably is for most people. It may not have been for me in my own career. I think the drivers are to do something new, to do something different, to create your own legacy, to something on which you want to leave your own imprint and say that this is what we did, either in terms of a new product, new service, something different which was brought to the world. It is the mindset of the inventor which says, I'm doing something which perhaps others have not done before, or in a way which has never been done. So it could be an idea which gets translated into either a new product or a new service. And I believe that most entrepreneurs really get driven by the idea.
So the passion behind the idea is the
sure.
real drive. And the wealth creation happens as a kind of corollary to that effort.
And no, it need not necessarily be that way. It could
okay.
be that one becomes the... You see, when I say that, because you're talking of individuals, each one will have his own passion.
Sure. Okay. And you know, I had the opportunity to talk with... Vinod Khosla a month back in mm-hmm. a similar format, and he said a very interesting thing. He said, my willingness to fail gives me the ability to succeed.
Yeah.
So how would you characterize your own experience.
Sure. And you know, I have heard this statement obviously from, you know, that you talk of really successful serial entrepreneurs, there's hardly anybody, and then he went on to become obviously one of the most successful VCs. And is again within that transformed himself several times. Now, you know, here I would say two or three things about failure. One, I think a lot of people will tell you, all the management gurus, that you must learn from your failures. And of course you should. But I must also say another part of that, and that is you must also learn from your successes. And I'll give you an analogy. I think if you watched a really tight game, take many sports, I can give you tennis as a one-to-one is a better example. When you see a real champion, sometimes almost on the verge of losing, and they say, this is going to be a disaster now, that person will suddenly turn things around and win. And I'll tell you, they do it by replicating their success. You can virtually visualize that person saying, now let me do the best I've ever done. Produce that unreturnable serve or that passing body or whatever it is, which in a sense brings about the success. So yes, there has to be learning from success, failure also. I know there's another angle about willingness to fail, and I'm going to come to that. But I think it's very important that you build on your success. I want to talk about a research study where two groups of people were given a problem. And then they were, the results were sort of surfaced, and they found that they were random groups brought together with similar backgrounds. The scores were at that point in time the same. One group was told all that they did exceedingly well. Another group was told all that they did badly. And then they were told, go back and do the experiment again. The group which was told the positives, their scores went up dramatically, and the group which were given their negatives remained maybe languishing around. The reason is that when you build on your success, actually you're going to see more upside. So I think that's an important part of success versus failure. Second part is, and I'll make a distinction here between failure and mistakes. I must tell you, everybody will make innumerable mistakes. If you ask me in my own, just those 10, 11 years of mind frame, how many mistakes we made, which cost us upwards of $500,000 per mistake. Different mistakes, not the same one over and over again. But certainly, there were more than, somewhere between 6 to 10. Now that's a lot of money, but remember I'm talking of blowing it up over a period of 10 years, and obviously we did something else, right, which made up for this. So there will be mistakes. Don't let them set you back so much that then it leads into, in a sense, despondency. Because that's another thing that an entrepreneur must avoid. And that is not getting carried away by early successes and high highs, and also not succumbing to low lows. That's incidentally a phrase I picked up from Kamal Rekhi when I first read it. I'm sure it's, I should acknowledge it. Now finally I come to this point about the willingness to fail, which Vinod has talked about. You know, I think all of us obviously, so what is all business is about taking risks. So to a certain extent I'd say it was an axiom. After all, if you're getting into business, you are going to have risks. The issue really is this, that in my view you should never take a risk which bets the company. That's the point. So of course there should be. So that is why I equated it with failure versus mistake. Now, he from a VC's angle probably looks at it also as saying, you know, in Silicon Valley they say that the best bet is a failed entrepreneur, where somebody has actually failed. Now that's not a mistake. The company's gone down the drain, perhaps blown up X million dollars of money. And yet when the entrepreneur comes back for a second round, second attempt, saying, I'm going to be able to build on my past experience, that person is hopefully going to do better. I don't think we've built that psychology in India as yet. And I think that's why this issue of being willing to fail. But I wouldn't carry it too far, you know, in the sense that, of course, because by definition, if you're in business, you're taking a risk.
Sure. Okay. At the same time, one mustn't de-risk it, you know,
excessively.
Excessively. So that what is not worth the risk.
For contra, when you're running that business, remember, you are going to take bets, and those bets should not. There will be innumerable things don't work out, like the stand $500,000 plus mistakes I talked about. But they shouldn't bet the company.
Now, one of the important aspects of entrepreneurship is, while you as the entrepreneur have the drive, the passion, the desire, the idea and all of that, how does one get a team around yourself, right, who starts believing with the same intensity in the vision,
sure,
right, and then go ahead and convince customers, investors and so on? What would your advice be?
You know, as an issue here, I would say that that's no different for an entrepreneur or for anybody who runs an organization to that extent. I'm sure all of us who've led organizations have really done that. And I can certainly say this of my Wipro days, of my earlier engineering days when I ran a company called Shriram Refrigeration, that you run it as an entrepreneur. So you really need to see how do you carry a team, how do you build a team. As an entrepreneur, you probably brought together a team of like-minded people, people who perhaps share your same thoughts, ideas, culture and vision. But then as your organization grows, you need to be able to build, I'd say, two things. One is a shared vision, and then a common set of values along which the organization is aligned. I think it's important to articulate those. I think the shared vision part is important in the sense that it's not something created in an ivory tower by the top management. I think the more you get the team to participate in that, in terms of saying what should be our, say whether it's a vision or five-year goals or whatever, define them together, share them and continuously communicate on them, and likewise bind the organization together through values along which the entire organization is aligned.
And that, I imagine, would be a constant.
It has to be a constant. You really never give up on doing that. And I'm sure from your own background of Wipro days, where you would see Mr. Premji would have actually had sessions on what they call as the beliefs of the company. And he would personally handle it with literally every new joining, until a few years back when I think it became too large and he delegated it. I did that all the my 11 years at Mindtree, where I may have shared the odd session with one of the other co-founders. But I would have done 90% of saying virtually everybody who joins goes through a session on mission, vision, values. And even that is not enough. You've got to be able to build these up into the values, for example, could be something you bring into your 360 degrees appraisal system, or feedback system, it's not so much as an appraisal, where your peers are able to assess for you, and your team is able to assess how well do each individual within the team either align with those values and follow those values in their way.
Alright, so effectively, which means a lot of communication,
a lot of
iteration of the goals and all of that.
And building it into your process.
In the process itself. What would you say, you know, have been some of the key challenges or inflection points that you have faced in the course of the last 10 to 11 years as part of your entrepreneurial journey?
Sure. You know, here, let me again step back and say, rather than what could have been my personal inflection, I'll come back to that.
Sure.
Let me try and generalize this for the benefit of anybody who is looking at the journey of a company as they either start it or whatever. And what are the typical inflection points the company may face? So I'd say that there are three phases in, or four phases in the life of a company. One is when you're in a startup phase, when you're literally scrambling, the success of the idea is not very clear in itself, you need an enormous amount of self-belief, you need the team to be cohesively working together to be able to achieve those. I would say then secondly, hopefully, and sometimes these may follow something like a technology curve, just when you begin to think that a new technology, you see those hype curves where they just remain flat for a while and they say this technology is not going to succeed, and then it takes off. And that tends to then happen in some idea which is going to take off. Particularly when it's a new market, new idea in itself. It then takes off because it requires a certain amount of critical mass, and those are the rapidly growing years. I'll call those the years of adolescence though. It's heady, exciting, and yet it's also confused and mixed because a lot of different pulls and pressures, how to manage that growth, are coming about. And then comes the age when you become a steady, somewhat more mature organization. And that is when, unfortunately, when you think that you can now coast along, is when you have to completely reinvent yourself. So that becomes literally the fourth stage. And I think most organizations will go through that. Each of those stages will be marked by their own milestones and what you may call, what you've called as inflection points. Along that way, some of the inflection points could be how you got your funding. A lot of inflection points today are introduced by the environment, and you've got to watch out for those. And they will impact different companies and different stages of this life cycle in a different way. Markets can come to virtually a stagnated ball game, a recessionary condition. Sometimes, though, I think you've got to realize that, and a lot of people ask me today, I mean, you're starting a new IT company when there's a slowdown, which I said, that's not my concern. I'm working in a $100 billion industry. And within that industry, I'm going to generate X million dollars of sales, whereas the larger companies are going to create a new mid-sized company every year. They're the ones who need to worry about the salary demand. And yet, one way or the other, the environment plays its role.
So that's the mindset. So the point that you made is a very important issue relating to mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So how does one, therefore, translate that in terms of getting employees to also start believing that here is an opportunity? Because that, I imagine, would be a challenge of sorts for an entrepreneur as well.
Sure. You know, firstly, to start with, I mean, and I'll touch for a moment on the philosophy behind Happiest Minds, where we are saying our mission is happiest people, happiest customers. And we've got a belief of saying that, you know, that's really important. That has to be one of the purposes of your life, even while we're talking about whether it is entrepreneurship. You ask about motivation. I think the basic motivation in one's life is what is it that makes me happy. Now, in that context, I think you've got to ask yourself, you know, nobody can make anybody happy, you can only enable happiness. So therefore, when you say, how do you get some of that, those qualities brought together in the team, you can't make that happen. But I think you can create an environment whereby you enable that to happen. And you focus that, and again, it comes through also very largely an issue of sharing that vision continuously on an ongoing basis. There's another angle, of course, to it, and that's if you're a monetary angle of saying, not by saying, hey, we're giving the highest salary, but by saying that we're going to create a shared wealth and be able to say that everybody who participates to help in building up this gets a chance to be able to create wealth.
Okay. So that's a very important thing, particularly in our country, right? The whole business of being part of the entire wealth creation process.
Absolutely.
That's a very important part for an entrepreneur as well. Now, let me move a little bit to the whole issue of raising funds, because you mentioned that that is one of the important milestones in the journey of an entrepreneur, because there is a third-party validation.
Sure.
So what would your advice be to entrepreneurs who are out seeking funds? What kinds of investors, what are the attributes they should look out for, and some sort of insight into the process itself?
Okay. Actually, you're, of course, maybe it's not right. I was going to say you're the better person to do it, but you're on the other side of the thing. But you need good parties to help you, like Sanjay's own venture. But if I were to look at some characteristics, you know, one thing I would tell you, and I've had, okay, now maybe experience of dealing with small VCs directly and many others indirectly, and that could have included a larger private equity company when I talk about that. See, everybody will tell you that it's intelligent money, and whereas they have their own demands and expectations of you, I think you've got to assess that where is that intelligence. They won't commit to you in the way that you would have to commit to them on how they would be able to directly help you, but you should be able to get a good assessment on that. So what is their own ecosystem? How much can they help you to open doors? What is their own track record on the way they have supported entrepreneurs? And there can be some who have, you know, squeeze entrepreneurs into very difficult situations. I don't, I hate that horrible phrase of vulture capitalism. I'm sure you hate it even more. But, because I found that at least the people I've dealt with, barring excluding that large private equity entity, which I mentioned, I don't have to take their name, but it came to me, obviously, as a surprise. We did exceedingly well in our first rounds at Mindtree, and then somewhat burnt our fingers in that second round. Is that sometimes the smaller, closer guys will work with you closer. They'll help you more. They're more supportive. So you need to have that supportive attitude. You've got to have somebody who's there for the long run, not going to push you into saying, okay, it has to be that we go public or we find an exit strategy in next years. Perhaps not take advantage of, the fact that there could be clauses where you get pushed into doing down rounds and things like that, or guard against that. You've got to be clear against that the VC will protect their interest in that area. So if there is a need for a down round, obviously they will insist on it. I think that, so it's really just judging by that sort of culture. And I think then you've got to also tailor this in context of saying what is it that you're seeking, what is the appropriate ticket size that the VC entity is looking for, because everybody has their own appetite. And most of them would prefer to do it on a shared risk basis. So in any case, you're going to have to deal with two or sometimes even more than two partners.
Right.
And how well do they actually work together?
Yeah.
At the same time, you don't want them excessively dealing that much well. There is then process asset in certain situations.
So that leads to an interesting point that all of a sudden you start a company, you've got a bunch of co-founders, you know, some key employees, then you go out and you raise money, right? And then you have new stakeholders who in a sense are answerable to. And then how does one go about this whole managing the board and, you know, the key stakeholders whose vision, you know, might not be entirely, you know, in congruence with your personal goals?
You know, there are two, three angles of a board, and I'd say there's a board when you've got a private limited company, and then when you've been able to take this forward to a public. Odds are that when you're a private limited company, and I would say from our own experience, you may have a few internal people, a few senior people on the board, and it's not unlikely that there's nobody else on that board other than the VCs themselves. You could have brought in, as we have done at Happiest Minds, we brought in our financial advisor, Gopal, also as a board member because of the expertise he brings. So in a sense, there are people who are very highly aligned to the fact that you've got to achieve results. So you're really working towards getting a goal. But even if you were to ask me what are some of the characteristics that you look for in a board member, or in a board as a whole when you're putting it together, this becomes much more applicable when you build a public limited board, as we did say in the case of Mindtree, or if I see the board that is existing at Wilkrobridge, you know, Mr. Premji would have created, but I was very much a part of the process of how it evolved. One is, I'd say you should look for complementary skills and capabilities, so that they're bringing in a variety of different types of skills to help enrich, because you really need capability in different aspects of running a business. So it's not that you just focus on somebody who knows the technology. There could be people who help you to open doors. I think at all times there must be people who have built a reputation for a high standard of governance themselves. But they come from organizations which are built aside. And then hopefully you're going to get people who understand your own business and the rhythms of that business. When you do that, they're more likely to understand the ups and downs of it rather than getting negative at times and status. I can again say one thing from my own experience that, you know, I'd say very high profile people, sometimes at a very high cost, because they have their own aspirations of what they come up with, don't necessarily translate into high value. So I'd be a little more cautious of it, and I would do it next time around.
So you have to be very careful between balancing having board members who are brand names in and as of themselves,
exactly,
versus those who are willing to roll up the sleeves and, you know, do stuff for the entrepreneur.
Sure.
Okay. And in terms of spotting opportunities, so after Mindtree you started Happiest Minds, what was the real opportunity that you saw? Sure. What was the process you went through? And what would your advice be to entrepreneurs? How do you determine what is an opportunity?
Sure. But I'll tell you one comparison again between the time we started Mindtree and the time I started with Happiest Minds. There's a commonality in the entry strategy. At the time of Mindtree, the internet was booming. It was changing the world in many ways. Of course, some of it collapsed with the dot-com bust. But the fact is, there was a new technology. That new technology became an entry strategy for a lot of companies. I think he has something he wants to ask you about.
Yes, sir.
So I'll just repeat that a bit. You know, the internet became an entry strategy. So what was it? There was something new. You could say the incumbents don't necessarily have more experience in that area. So it becomes a new entry point for a whole chunk of new entrants. The logic behind the areas that we focused at Happiest Minds is exactly the same. We said if the internet could spawn literally hundreds of companies around the world, why is it that the newer technologies today, and they're all disruptive technologies, cloud, mobility, social media, analytics, the changes in security requirements has arising out of the fact that security is no longer an enterprise issue, but literally taking you into, your resources are outside of the cloud, you've got devices connecting to your organization through mobility, and social media is connecting you to maybe hundreds of thousands and millions of people. All of that imposes new security issues. Why is it that these have not become the focal point for a new entity? It's surprising it didn't happen. And so that becomes the entry strategy for Happiest Minds. So what's the principle behind it? The principle has to be, is there something new, which is either a new product, a new service, a new way of doing things, a different way of reaching your customer through channels which didn't exist in the past? I think there has to be something there that you pick up and say, I can do this differently. which doesn't place me at a disadvantage with respect to the incumbents.
Okay. And, you know, so if one looks at these new technologies and, like you said, determines what are therefore the new opportunities that get spawned by the new technologies, one of the important things that arise from that is how do I therefore take this proposition to the market,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the sales and marketing piece of it. And typically, you know, companies that operate in India and from India tend, you know, to be a little weak in sales and marketing compared to their Western counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
So what has been your own experience and what would your suggestions and advice be?
Sure. You know, of course, a lot of people have asked me in the past, why is it India hasn't created products? And the reason is not the capability to create a product. It is, as you have actually said, taking those into the market. And the reason, of course, is multiple. It may not necessarily be poor marketing or sales capability, but in the case of a product, of course, it's a question of creating a global brand and the resources that you have. It's also fashion in a sense. People are going to align behind products which have been created in advanced markets. So, and yet you might say, the plus point I must tell you, I'm amazed. Because of the entrepreneurial activity we have in our country, how many new product companies are coming in? And their companies, interestingly, when I talk of products, I will add on to that, pure internet companies which are creating platforms on the basis of which the business runs.
Right.
And this is actually now a fantastic opportunity for us, for those companies, to actually overcome what you have called as the disadvantage that you perceived in the past. Because suddenly your market is the globe. You don't have to go through that physical process of saying, I'm going to step up offices in multiple countries, which each one of them requires a huge decision. When I talked of the mistakes made in the past, one of the most expensive mistakes you could make is when you choose a wrong person to represent you in a market. I would say when we entered into the UK and we chose the wrong guy, before you knew it, he'd set you back by £1 million. Not just in terms of the fact that what he cost us, but the opportunity cost might have actually run into £2-3 million by the time you found him out. Now if you can reach out to your customer through the net, you create a global market straight away. That's a fantastic opportunity which is available to everybody. We're no longer at a disadvantage. And in fact, you might say that we haven't created that physical brick and mortar. So industries which lend themselves to, I'd say, pure non-brick and mortar marketing should really take that whole hog and take it forward. Because that's where the growth lies. You look at any new industry. Take retail today. Internet retail or online retail is growing at the rate of 20%, whereas the industry is growing 3-4%.
Right.
So that's where the opportunity is at. Avail of those, avail of new channels, if you will. Now, having said that, there may be so many industries like ours where your real sales is going to happen on a face-to-face physical presence. And I think here the important aspect of this is, again, how do you bring across your differentiators? What is it that segregates? And once you've got that, you get that expertise. Some businesses are pure expertise-based, so you have to get that expertise understood by the customer, that selling differentiator.
And this is my last question before we throw it open to the audience. This extraordinary journey that you've been through, you know, as a senior corporate executive, as a very successful entrepreneur, all of that. So what would you say, if you were to look back upon your own life and career, what would you say are the key reasons for your own success?
You know, that must be the most difficult thing too. And you saved the most tough one for the end. I'll tell you a few important things. I think you've got to enjoy what you're doing. And I think a corollary to that is when somebody asks me, hey, why do you choose to start a company again at literally you become a late stage serial entrepreneur? And that's because I enjoyed what I was doing. So if you got that, and you have a passion in a sense for that in itself, I think you're bound to be able to get success to a certain extent. But let me also now broaden the question and say, what is it that leads to creating a successful organization? You've got your idea. What is it that you need to be able to do to create success? And I would say there are four or five issues which are important. The first is building an organization. You've got to be able to do all that is needed to create your processes, your systems. Obviously, the right people, shared wealth creation, that becomes very important. The second thing we've talked about is values and creating an organization which is align you around the same set of values. The third, we've talked about funding for that matter, get your right funding strategy in place. The next one, we've talked about entry strategies. In a business, if you don't have the right entry strategy, and you've got to be clear that almost any differentiator that you create will at best last for 3 years. So barring soft differentiators, a cultural differentiator may last you forever, hopefully. But the technology differentiators or your market differentiators, you have to keep on reinventing yourself. I'd say, and then finally I would add one thing, you're also as weak as your weakest link. So while you're going to be strong, you can't fail. You've got to have a few core competencies you build up, that is focusing on your successes. But also avoid those weakest links, or see how you're going to supplement them. Because you can't say that there's a given area that we are not good at. You know, any one of them can pull you down. A company with a poor people's focus, a company with a bad financial strategy, they may have the most wonderful technology, but if those are their weak links, those will lead to failure. So avoid some of the common things which could lead to failure, and build on those factors which I said lead to success.
So thanks. So now, you know, it's open to the audience. First question. Yes, sir.
Yeah, my name is Basan. I'm with a company called Lister Technologies, and I'm an alumnus of IIT Madras. So my question is this, right? When you build an organization, when you talk about vision, mission, and values, I presume the fundamental reason you have them is to balance the empowerment versus control, right? In the way you manage the organization. You set a direction, you set the values, and you hope that you don't have to micromanage whatever you have to do, because these will be the guiding principles. But fundamentally, there are so many stakeholders in an organization, and ultimately there is this money factor. So how do you get alignment to a vision which is supposed to be the driving factor, to an extent where people feel emotionally connected and passionate? How do you do that? Because always there can be, it's like a common minimum agenda.
Right.
Would it really become a vision?
Right.
Unless in a situation like organizations which are like terrorist organizations or or a freedom fighting group, what Gandhi did.
Terrorist organization, which has got an overarching goal, which is a national magnet.
Yeah. So,
okay.
So how do you do that in businesses?
Right. Mm-hmm. Any other sort of related questions or comments? Yes, sir.
Hey, R. Ramalingam with Citrus Solutions. Along the same lines, you're selling a workplace, a happy workplace work. How do you sell it during recruiting, or what kind of challenges you see during recruiting, getting a team built?
So how do you sell a happy workplace idea to people in real terms?
Yes.
Is that your question?
Specifically during recruiting.
During recruitment, okay. Last question before we move on to Ashok Sutta for his responses to these.
Probably
the bad news is whoever has the mic wins, right? So, sorry, we'll come back to you.
We'll take these three and then we've got a cluster of four or five.
Yeah, at the back, yes.
Just to build on that question that the gentleman in the back asked, my name is Chandramouli Prasanna. I work with Cisco Systems. How do you verify that the people that you're going to recruit have the same values? What is the test?
How do you verify that the people have the
how
same values?
How do you know that these people that you're going to get on your team have the same values? I mean, unless you have some shared experiences in the past,
sure. Right.
You're not going to be able to know whether they share these values with you.
Sure. Right. Thank you.
Sure.
All yours. Okay.
So, you know, let me start with Vasan's question here. And, you know, the first thing I must say is that you made a statement which I must disagree with in this first instance. You said the main objective of mission, vision, values is to balance empowerment and control so that you're not necessarily micromanaging. To my mind, the main objective of all of these is you're really sharing, hey, this is what we're all about. You're bringing everybody onto the same page, the same wavelength, the same common direction, and then we begin to move in that direction. I think, to my mind, this balance between empowerment and control comes much more through your processes, your policies, and how you go along. And if you don't do those well, obviously, I talk to you as strong as your weakest link. I mean, you may have got the most wonderful vision And if you did have things which gave people the sort of freedom and power that they wanted, in order to be able to execute and implement, then obviously that would become an area which would drag you down. So there is a superordinate goal for an organization. I hate your comparison of terrorism, but actually that is the superordinate. The mission, vision, values are your superordinate goal. And once you get people to realize that that is, in a sense, the reason for your existence, and that is shared by everybody, then you're all moving in the same path. And maybe a better example, like a religious order perhaps, or a set of people who literally have come together for a common cause. NGOs are a wonderful example of that. They're working for a cause. So if you can give people a higher purpose and saying we're here not just to be able to make money, and which is why the importance sometimes of emphasizing social responsibility. You know, research on happiness shows that your happiest moments in life, and I invite any one of you to look back on it, and some of you have not had very long lives as yet, but even for you it would apply, is your happiest moments are those when you gave rather than you took. What is it that really brought you long-lasting satisfaction? When you had a little celebration that was fun, you look back on the happiest moments are the moments that you give. So it's important to be able to define those. And that also then provides a superordinate. If the goal which is above the purpose of yes, say, let's make money. Once you align people along that, I think you'll get this thing. You also mentioned something about multiple stakeholders and how do you align all of their needs. So I think you need to be able to build that into your vision, for example. And let's talk about financial stakeholders. So if your vision only said that we're going to achieve results, work in a certain way, we're also going to give back to society, you've also got to realize that one part of it is to meet their needs. And the vision should encompass that. And it must take into account the needs of all stakeholders. And that's not a very difficult task to do. Because in the end, your goal and theirs ultimately is to create a successful organization. And in that process, you would meet their needs too. Having said that, there may be one set of needs, vision elements that you describe for your team, another set that you describe in terms of customer satisfaction, and the third set you describe, in a sense, for the financial stakeholders, and the fourth is for society at large. I believe that any vision statement must really have elements which cover at least these four. The point that was being raised, and I'm not sure I got the names of the next two gentlemen, but about selling the idea of a happy workplace to people. You know, I think again it's actually the other way around. Once you're seen as a happy place, you don't have to sell it. That becomes your methodology to attract people. People say, hey, this is a great place to work. So how do you firstly create a great place to work? And having got that, how does that reputation spread around so that it attracts people to your workplace? I would say that in the case of Happiest Minds, the fact that the name in itself attracts people, because somebody says, hey, look, this is what's intended, makes people think that, oh, I want to be happy. Having said that, we've also got to live up to that challenge. Actually, we've got a name which we have to live up to. So the issue isn't how do you attract people to the idea of happiness. When you make people reflect on it, everybody wants to be happy. They have thought about it more often than not. How do you get it across? Sometimes it may be for a company which has been around for a while, there are a lot of structured studies on what are the best places to work in, etc. But I think the more important one, and particularly in an industry like ours where everybody's networked, is really word of mouth. I think people will get to know what are the great places to work, or what are the happy places to work. And when you do that, it becomes a magnet for talent. And the third one is really it's a difficult one. How do you verify? Obviously you don't know who's going to have exactly the same values. But I tell you, in terms of fundamentally, it's not that, any of these are mutually exclusive values. I mean, what you really said is that there are some things which are really key and important to our organization. If you read the values of any organization, it's nobody's going to frame dysfunctional values, articulative dysfunctional ones. When you get down to values, you want people as they come up to align themselves behind the values that you have said are important for the company. And it's not something in their makeup which is going to say this is contrary. There could be some. Another aspect is what is your belief in human nature. I actually believe, and people have different aspects, that in the end, maybe 98% of the people in the world are very, very good. It's the 2% who can brought a lot of mischief and have a huge amount of negativity on the rest of the world. And there will be dysfunctional people who will enter any organization, for that matter. That same 2% may have different scales. A criminal politician in or politicians may attract a larger amount of that dysfunctional group as distinct from a corporate entity, but they will be there. You would, of course, frame your questions, align yourself, watch that carefully enough, and certainly you can create questionnaires. We today are trying to create an approach of assessing people's attitude towards happiness. And as they come up, we actually ask each and every person who's joining to say what makes me happy. You need to understand what is the mindset of the person as they come up. What is it that they truly value? Now, we are doing it as much for ourselves as we are doing it for the person. We are saying, how many people have actually dwelt on the fact that what makes me happy? There was a wonderful, statement, and I noticed we have somebody here from the press who I just met a little while earlier, and I'm going to be a little repetitive for her. I said, Clayton Christensen, many of you would know him. He is the famous, one of the best-known professors at Harvard, the author of Innovator's Dilemma, Innovator's Solution, and now a third book. He said that most people underinvest in their lives in what makes them happy. They don't realize it, and that becomes a source of the biggest regret for them as they look back on their lives. So what we're trying to do is to avoid people from having that regret later on by saying, these are the things that make me happy, now focus on that. Once you've got people thinking that way, align them along values, it's not so much a filtering out process. If you start with the basis that 98% will align themselves behind it, I think you're not likely to have a problem. Can you weed out the 2%? It would be wonderful to be good. And I think if you focus on it, maybe you weed out half of that. There's no way you're going to get 100%.
Thanks. Next set of questions, please. From the back. We'll start on the back this time.
Good evening, everybody. Myself, Hitesh, MS scholar in the Department of Mechanical Engineering. I have a question at this point of time that I believe mindset Maitri has the companies has customers all across the globe. So, when you approach a new customer, what are all the strategies you adopt to win that customer first time? What are the key attributes or characteristics that helps to win that customer first time?
Okay.
This, can you share your experience in this aspect?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
How do you find your first customers and what's the strategy for getting the first set of customers? Is that right? Okay. Yeah, in front here. Next, there. Please. Go ahead.
Hi, sir. My name is Vartraj. I used to work for Venture Intelligence.
What's that, Jay?
When you're starting for a company as a young entrepreneur, you have a small team and most of them being a product, they usually build products. But as the company goes, the entrepreneur needs to become more of a people manager. I mean, he needs to get work done through his people. How does he really make the transition from being a builder kind of thing to be more of a people, getting work done through people?
Excellent question. Very good. Yes, sir.
Hi, Prem. I run a small business magazine called The Smart CEO. My question is, in the IT industry, right, if you look at Infosys, Mindtree, all these different companies, they have many different co-founders. How do you manage to work with 8, 9, 10 co-founders? For us in the startup world, where we are starting off really small companies, it's managing relationships with co-founders seems to be our biggest problem. So, some insights into how you do that really well.
How do you manage co-founders? All right.
So there are two people related questions and one global strategy.
One more question or?
Yeah.
Okay. Last question before we move on this side.
Yeah, I'm Jagdishan from Unitech Plaster Components, owning a company. Our friend said, in fact, we have grown to some extent now. We want to delegate a job to a next level. And where I need to interfere in his activity once if I delegate my responsibility to him, or leave him to his own. Of course, it may lead to a failure also sometimes. Do I need to interfere or not?
How do I delegate? How do I not micromanage? How do I have confidence?
That's true.
Right. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Okay. So really, three people-related question and one market entry. Let me take the market entry question first. And your first question, I think Sanjay helped to amplify it by saying, how do you get literally your first set of customers? I must share one experience with you. When we started Mindtree, my biggest fear was, why on earth should anybody come to us? Even though there was a booming internet market at that time. When I took charge of Wipro, it was a $2 million business, but at least it was still $2 million. We already had those customers. That was a new industry at that time. Here I was wondering, why should anybody at all come to us? And it was a fear. And then, strangely enough, in that time it was a booming market, so maybe there was so much work to be done that we really had no difficulty attracting customers. Now we've started the Happiest Minds. And again, you might say, I might have had that same fear in my mind. And then, you know, if you look at our business, actually the lead time to get a new customer in the IT services space is 6 to 9 months. You go to somebody, you get qualified as a vendor, and that's a long process. Then they give you an RFP where you bid along with other people and so on. And here, we're today 140 days old, by the way, as a company. When we got our funding, we were 120 days old, and we announced we had 6 customers. So how did we get so many customers in such a brief period? And there's one wonderful thing I must assure you of, you'll find that everywhere, that in the end, if you've got something special that you're bringing together as an expertise, people want that expertise. It doesn't have to be that you're either, for example, in our case, the advantage is that obviously it's a seasoned team, but if you can demonstrate that expertise even as young entrepreneurs, there's no reason why that should not be a source of being able to bring in new customers. The second thing is, in fact, one of our VCs this time has a wonderful ecosystem, and that's Intel Capital, where they, at an annual summit, bring together some of their large partners with, in a sense, their portfolio companies. And, you know, the philosophy behind that is that a lot of large companies actually want to work with people with the latest technology and young startups. They don't know how to find them, and vice versa. The young companies don't have access to those large entities. Okay, how can you help network? The concept is the larger players are actually willing to work and quite open to work with smaller younger players. As long as you're able to demonstrate the process. Third thing you've also got to appreciate that all large players actually have their weaknesses. How do you pick and spot those? And it may be the largest, you know, in our type of business, does a customer necessarily want to deal with, amongst the largest players, people who've got, 10,000 customers or 2,000, 3,000 customers for whom their business is not that valuable. When they come to a startup, they know that you're going to throw whatever you can, you go more than the extra mile to meet their needs. And any experience-based business will grant you. So, multiple approaches. You would start with the confidence that when there's a market, when you've got the right solution, you will be able to get the customers. And at least I can say for ourselves that we've clearly had 2 experiences which worked out well enough that one of my biggest fears became the point which I realized in retrospect need not have been a concern. So let's move to the 3 people-related areas. Having said this, I don't want to make it sound that it's all that easy. You know, I must say our experience might have been a little different. We've gotten such an experienced team. It's more than likely that you'll follow the path that I said when I talked about an early stage. You begin to fret and wonder whether you're going to get results, and then suddenly you start getting the breakthroughs. So you've got to be prepared for some of those lead times. Coming down to the people-related areas, there were 2 or 3 of these, and that one said, how do you make a transition between being a person doing things, a product, and a people manager as the organization gets larger. Another one talked about, managing multiple co-founders with different types of approaches. The third one was really, how do you delegate, etc., and so on, at what stage and how do you get your balances. Let me take the very last one, I think, Jagdish, you had that question there. Now, talking of failures, I just read yesterday that one of the most important things is allow your people to make their mistakes. Now, as distinct from an organization failure, I'm saying every one of us makes mistakes. So allow the people also to make their mistakes as they go around. And I think if you start with that basis, as long as everybody is aligned, a common set, and we've talked about vision, but I think I have to move on an operational basis, that everybody has their own objectives. They're being assessed against the objectives and you're measuring against them. So if you visualize the output and then measure against that and say, as long as we're getting there will be mistakes along the way. There will be things which at times don't seem to be going as well as they should. As long as you know that we're on that journey and each one is going to be able to achieve that and assess it. So I do believe that management by objectives becomes a very important part of that. Once you define those, you leave people to achieve those objectives. Summation of those objectives help the company to do its results. The Second question, I didn't know the name of the gentleman who asked. I know you're the... about how do you manage different co-founders? It is a challenge. Co-founding team. I must tell you my own experience here. When we began Mindtree, actually. In fact, I had a bigger challenge there, in the sense that we had people from multiple cultural backgrounds that way, because there was a whole set of people who were from Cambridge Technology Partners in the US. Many of us are from other domestic companies, some of which from crypto. Now, when we came together, I found there's a huge gap. I had managed such senior people in Wipro, and suddenly getting this team together, they all seemed to be pulling in different directions. There were three different nationalities amongst them. And what somebody thought was micromanagement, the other fellow felt was the application of duty. And then there would be endless issues of pulling together different streams. And we had a very lucky coincidence at that time, and that is that at that stage, we had called in a professor from a college in New York, Fordham College in New York. We had an entire middle management of the company with us for this session, a consulting session, and it was maybe a team of about 25-30 people at the end. We were in our first year. And I asked him this question of how do you manage these cultural differences, particularly in a founding team, and in effect the new entrants that have come in, because each one of those founders brought in people who were somewhat similar to them or from their own background. So now you suddenly have virtually three or four different approaches within, and almost like people wanting to go in different ways. So he said, first he had a wonderful response. He said, never think of culture as something to be managed, and also different cultural approaches as a problem. Think of these as new ways of getting ideas, new thoughts, new ways of doing things, different ways of doing things. However, what you need then to do is to align the organization around your values. At that time, he asked us a question of saying, what are the values of Mindtree? We had articulated our values just as we had articulated our mission and vision. And then I asked the middle management team, would any one of you, top and middle management team, would you like to go and articulate the values of Mindtree? Strangely enough, nobody wanted to get onto the board and say them. So I said, look, if you don't, not that you expect me to remember them by heart, but if you don't remember them in a sense, in a broader sense even, then how have you internalized? And that is what led us to go back to the drawing board. And we created at that stage what we call, through a very participatory process, what we named as the class values of Mindtree, which is caring, learning, achieving, sharing, and social responsibility. And then we began the process we discussed for the internalizing. So I think if you get people aligned behind, I'd say, a larger purpose, as we talked about, is there a larger purpose to an organization? As well as you get them aligned towards your values and you share a common vision, I think you move in the same direction. I don't see that as saying it's a co-founders versus it's the entire team in a way. And that brings you on to the question of how do you make a transition. Every manager has to make that transition. As you grow up in your early stages in your life, you will find that sometimes the people who have a very high personal output tend to become the worst in terms of realizing that what you do yourself is going to be a very small part of what you can do in terms of leverage to an organization. In fact, one of the best counseling advices I received in maybe my second or third years of my career was from one of my earliest bosses, very thorough, painstaking, detailed individual, where he told me that, look here, your own personal output is so high that are you missing out on the opportunity of getting the leveraged output of your team? And actually, if you set me to so that if you realize that what you're going to achieve, in the end, there's just so much you can do on your own. So, and it's better to realize that as you grow larger in the organization, if you take an approach of saying that you're going to have specialists under you, I think the approach of any leader must be that how do you learn in a sense from your own team? Because they're the specialists as you go ahead. And so if you have that attitude and say, how am I going to get, in a sense, a much higher output for the organization, that you're going to work through? And Of course, we can put in the appropriate people, policies, and an environment in which people are encouraged to succeed. If you make it your own goal of saying, I want to fulfill my own potential and enable others to fulfill theirs.
You know, so an important takeaway, if I can summarize it somewhat, you know, tongue in cheek and in a sort of a, almost facetious manner, you don't buy a dog and do the barking yourself, right? So it's very important to learn how to delegate and let the specialists do the job, and you provide the environment in which they do it, right? Okay, moving on. Yeah.
Hey, good evening, sir. I'm Suresh. Recently started a venture into product development consulting and telehealth. My question is, you briefly touched upon the lack of product companies from India. So I used to, out of my 15 years of experience, I used to be in service industry for 14 years, used to work for Wipro, HCL. So how does the superpower service industry helping or not helping the product company or the product culture in India? There isn't, in the early stage of my career, I thought all service companies will end up making products at some point, but then I realized the business model of service is very different from product, and they will never, you know, change the direction. So that's the first part. And the related question which I have is, how much responsibility the service company should have, or the established service company should have, in encouraging the new product ideas to solve problems in India? For example, someone comes with a, you know, a big idea, but don't have resources because the resources are with the service company. How much responsibility a service company should have to encourage those ideas?
Okay.
Yes, my name is Satyanarayan, and I run a book publishing company. You've been in the IT industry and have been an entrepreneur in the IT industry, but you also have the unique background of having worked in the non-IT sector for a long time. So what are your thoughts on the opportunities in the non-IT sector, entrepreneurial opportunities, and also in terms of entrepreneurial opportunities in the social sector?
In the front, last question for this group, yeah.
My name is Lakshman Pillai, CEO of LPCube, with a product company. And it's, my also question is a little bit related to what he's asking related to product company versus services company. And see, I'll make it very specific. We need your advice on how to take the next generation enterprise solutions. So I'm not talking about consumer solutions now. The next generation enterprise solutions is really create, take, you know, workplaces and enterprise to the next level. And how actually we can actually go about marketing. So I'm looking at a couple of options, and both options I need your advice. The one, do you think the cloud will eliminate a lot of those roadblocks? And the cloud, do you think that it will be a greatest platform for the startup offering enterprise solutions to go to the market easily with the EMI options and whatever cloud properties, you know, good points that you already have? That's one angle to it. The other angle to it actually, how, I mean, you have started a company with a clean sheet of paper, and you are a services organization. I assume that it's not so much a product. How can we align yourself with companies like you, and we can build a fresh relationship, and you have the greatest build, you know, bridges to a lot of, you know, prospects and marketplaces around the globe. And there's one person called, you know, Zogo CEO, he mentioned it's easy to make $1 than ₹1.
Yep.
So we can't go, actually go, and everybody cannot go and set up an office in the US and start selling to the US customers. So we need your help, and at the same time we need to you know, leverage the cloud platform with these two, and how we can collectively win and succeed.
Thanks. Anything else? Okay.
My question is related to what this gentleman asked.
Yes.
So my name is Mahesh, I'm a faculty here. Non-IT sector, specifically manufactured products, there's a dire need, I think, for the manufactured products industry to take off, an indigenous manufactured product industry to take off in India, and what role can VCs and entrepreneurs play in that?
Thank you.
So there are two questions actually on non-IT per se and what can be done, and one was very specifically saying, hey, what are the opportunities in non-IT sector, and then specifically social sector, and yours is again manufacturing products. You know, I'll tell you, there's a very interesting phenomenon right now. And you might say the opportunities are where the money goes. And whereas maybe, I'm not sure whether Sanjay, because he funds the entities, could see where the money is flowing. And it may differ from, you know, because different VCs will focus on different areas. But you know, when we began Mindtree 11 years ago, I'd say that the only space which people believed in the VC community in India was IT. Because there is no other story. There is an IT story, it is largely a services story. Today, it's almost the other way around. Because there's a sense of sort of slowing down, flattening off of the industry per se. And I'm talking the services industry. If Happiest Minds has been able to raise so much money, it's almost like an exception, you might say. So where is the money going? It's going into platform companies, it's going into product companies, it's going into virtually every other sector. So alternate energy, healthcare, telecom was there and again is now slowing down, but a lot of money for any specialist entity in that area. So there's a huge amount of funds being directed towards these because that's where people see the newer opportunities coming around. And that's the great news. Virtually everything else has opened up. It is somebody who wants to start a services company would really have to struggle. And I can say this in shared experience. I literally got the money when we began Mindtree through one phone call where I was able to state how much money I wanted and the percentage I needed to give. Notwithstanding the fact that this time there was another, I had so many more years of experience behind, but there could have been other factors. The markets were slowing down even while we did this. You know, the recession had begun that time, it was still the time of the dot-com boom. But even then, it took its months and hard, pretty hard bargaining, I can tell you, before we could get the fund. And I believe that most services companies, pure services companies, would find it very difficult. But they would also be able to raise small amounts of angel money, etc., available all the time. Particularly if somebody says, I have a focused analytics company, say, and then you could grow it and then become a new Sigma. And that's a different issue. Because they've also done for years of track record. But there are almost the exceptions. I would say 80 to 90% of the money is going into other sectors. I'm not sure whether, Sanjay, that's your experience.
That's absolutely right. Because most money that is flowing into the country today is flowing into non-IT or non-traditional technology as the way we understand it. Right? Healthcare, education is big. Manufacturing is seeing a lot of money flowing in. Okay, so you're seeing all of these traditional sectors attracting huge sums of money. And Arun can provide you with a lot of data as well on, you know, the exact numbers.
That's one thing. On manufacturing, I do always want to put a rider. If you're manufacturing in India, frankly, I think one of the reasons that IT succeeded in India versus the way we struggled in manufacturing, firstly, there were faulty policies. Some of the policies have been removed, have been improved, I'd say, not removed per se, but still there's a huge overall efficiency disadvantage. We have to, what I say is the software could escape the tyranny of our infrastructure. Dreadful, I mean, our roads and the distances and the customs clearance cycles and stuff like that. They still exist, but I think you can see the turnaround coming. I think you can see a very large proportion and virtually every varying type of product being created now in the small scale sector. You know, so even if you see consumer goods, for that matter, just look at the way they're beginning to flourish. And it's really small names, they may be supplying it to some of the larger entities under their brands. But a lot of specialized products are coming out, in a sense, in a small scale and medium scale sector. Okay? And there was another part of the first question is on social sector and what are the opportunities there. Again, increasing all the time. I won't say there are tons of it. You've got an entity like the Ashoka Trust, which supports through various organizations. So in Mindtree, we may have then supported a social entrepreneur who was, in a sense, an Ashoka fellow. There are organizations like that you can tap into. There's microfinance, which are very largely developed, focused towards the social sector, which didn't exist. Yes, there are opportunities available. Perhaps obviously not as large as some of the others that you'd like to. A good way to be able to perhaps latch on to looking for opportunities like that would be through an NGO which wants to be able to work in those areas and say rather than be the delivery mechanism for that ourselves, we create the funding and then look for a social entrepreneur to be able to be the delivery mechanism. you know, whatever is the opportunity to create a problem. Now, I'm myself planning to create one such NGO, which I hope to launch. Should have been done earlier, except the fact that I deferred it in context of the decision to have its minds first. And that would be to work, say, for example, in the area of employability and skills. Could be something that one could work on this along with the social media. Now, the next set of questions on, what's service versus products. You know, one thing I think you must visualize is that the two industries are, there were two people who really had questions in that area. They're two separate industries, be very clear about it. And you know, when everybody says, why aren't the services company doing a product? I tell you, the rhythms of the two businesses are very different. We took a very short-lived effort to do this in Maitri, where we launched announced intentions of creating a phone, and then frankly just a little while before it was due to really could have taken off. In a sense, the organization suddenly found there wasn't enough will to see it through, because it has a different cycle, a different risk reward ratio, and so on and so forth. The other thing about a product, I must tell you, is you live, breathe, dream, think that one product. You've got a set of four focused competitors around whom you will typically compete on a global basis or within the country. In the services business, you've got a diverse range of offerings. A lot of their technology, notwithstanding any of what you might call as your domain knowledge, will actually come from the customer. You've got to see how you bring in your technology capability to add value to that customer. It's nobody who says I've got wonderful domain knowledge would even have 10% of what the customer is having. So, there are different businesses with different rhythms and different returns. You know, you've got to visualize the service business yields you a very, once you've got going, it yields you a very steady stream of returns. A product business will have its ups and downs. It may have a very rapid increase, it can also have a very rapid decline. It may take a very long time in terms of gestation to become profitable. And you can't marry those two businesses under the same umbrella. Now, having said that, two or three things are happening. One is that the distinction between products and services is going to disappear, or is disappearing in some areas. So when you hear a product as a service, the delivery mechanism of a product is a service. The second aspect is productized solutions. So you don't create an IT services company, would not create a full-fledged product which is going to be a mass, going out to millions of customers like Microsoft or ABOC. But it's still a repeatable product as solution. Within that, there may be building blocks which are like almost like products in themselves. Or there could be technologies around which you do a lot of repeatable sales, like say Bluetooth or whatever for Maitri. So, yes, to some extent there's that, but it's not mass manufacturing. And then you had another question, that what are service companies doing to encourage products? In a sense, you might say they have no responsibility towards them, because they're two separate businesses. Having said that, there can be ways in which they can be a lot of leverage. And I would say how it works for Happiness Minds, I mean, for us it's a very core part of our strategy. What we are saying is one part of our business, our product engineering services business, in fact, it's not really a full-fledged product engineering services, and so it doesn't cover the hardware bit at least at the moment, but software product engineering, and today most products in any case are software-based. One of our business lines. So we will help create those platforms that I talked about for our customers, or the products that we create for our customers. So we will be doing the crown jewels for them. And then we say that can our IT services arm pick up that product, provide services around enlarging the market for that product. And saying that we could become, in a sense, your professional services arm or your implementation arm, so that we are not saying all we are going to go out and do is to become an SAP implementer, etc. In fact, we are not focusing on this. Our intention is to build many of our practices, or our services, if you will, solutions around the product companies whom we are scaling and assisting in. So they become our customers, in turn we help them to make their products successful and enlarge their market. And it becomes a business line for us. So there can be ways in which product and services companies can work together. Now, then there was this question on, we had this non-IT manufacturer. I think we've covered that. It was a question of, hey, how important is the cloud and how much change is it going to bring about? And there was a second aspect, Lakshman, to your question. How do companies alive?
And how can IT services companies or even a company like Happiest Minds work with a product, a company, such that a small product company can align with a larger IT services company and go to market? Is that right?
So, in a sense, this is what I've just said. Why should, you know, you could really say, I said it in a purely selfish way, where I said, if we helped develop a product and somebody gave that to our software product engineering business, we would, in principle, like to say, can we also help you to take your product to the market? But it doesn't have to be confined to that. There will be many product solutions which companies want to take to the market. And that doesn't have to be developed in-house, because we're not a product company. So it's how do we license out there? And if there's a great opportunity, and we see we have got a greater market focus, and yet there is something unique which makes can make a difference to our customers, there's no reason why one should not look at that and say, fine, we would license out your technology to be able to provide it as a solution maybe to our customers or maybe a royalty basis or whatever. But we take it out to the market. So in essence, there's no reason why a product company cannot leverage on a larger arm, and yet you'd have to be able to convince them that you're there to be able to sustain and support the product full-fledged. So that we end up, and I'm sure that we don't leave our customers with a platform which may not be around after some years or doesn't have a growth path in itself. Which is why we are so much more comfortable when we do that with companies whose products we would be developing. But in principle, it's not the same. You don't have to do it for companies whom you are developing. How different is the cloud going to make things? You know, any new technology, you're going to be clear one thing, is that there will be some winners and some losers. There will be people who've been doing things the old way, didn't use that, and suddenly you find that their product or their offering is suddenly either getting cannibalized by something new. By definition, for a startup, you should be amongst the winners. And you're going to see what is it that is going to get cannibalized. And maybe that becomes your target market in a sense. You're saying you're displacing somebody who's doing something. And that becomes another entry strategy, which people wouldn't quite realize. It's just like suddenly developing, you know, the way the mobile phone is literally suddenly changing, eliminating product after product. I mean, the GIS companies, the GPRS companies are in trouble. Tomorrow, camera companies are going to be in trouble. I mean, they already are, in a certain sense, because how much people, the next generation is going to keep using their phone as their camera, because you're carrying it around to be used at a drop of a hat, and the quality of those cameras is improving by the day.
The world's largest phone company is Nokia. Yes, next set of questions. Yeah, from Jim. So we should keep this as the last set.
Hi, my name is Arun Athiyappan. I'm the CEO of TicketCruise.com. We aggregate bus tickets online. My question is this. IT services were the backbone for the growth of Indian economy the last couple of decades. And almost everyone from any other discipline, be it a mechanical engineer or be it an analytical engineer, they wanted to get into the IT services space. Having said that, don't you think that the growth of IT services in India has robbed India of the other opportunities, getting everyone else just focused on this IT services space? And almost probably just one of the reasons why our manufacturing sectors or any other sector didn't take off that.
All the mechanical engineers are writing software code. Okay.
I myself am a mechanical engineer and I have written software code today.
What's the name of the company you said?
TicketGoose.com?
TicketGoose.com.
When did you start this company?
2007.
And what is it called again? TicketGoose. What does that mean?
It was supposed to be a portal where we'll aggregate any ticketing needs, be it a ticket for buses or cinemas or anything. But now we are focusing only on buses because that itself seems to be a huge space to address.
Hello.
Yes.
My name is Rakesh. I have a very small startup, so my question is on the lifestyle, the life cycle that you have mentioned, the four stages. For the first stage, is there any thumb rule which says like you have to grow within a certain period of time, or it's not going to grow at after that? Is there a thumb rule for
so when you decide to pull the plug?
Yes, yes.
Right?
Yes.
Is it enough? Is enough?
Yeah. Yeah.
I've done all that I could. It's time to pack up and go back to corporate life.
No. Maybe you also
start something else. Okay. All right.
So I have another
small one.
Yes.
I have got the thrust of that question.
So his question is, when you are on your first voyage as an entrepreneur, at what point do you say enough is enough?
Okay, things and, are not going well?
Yes.
Or?
And this venture is done, and therefore I need to do something else. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
And is it prudent to have a plan B in such a case?
Okay. Should you have a plan B?
A person should have a plan B.
Okay.
When you're getting into a venture.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, in the front here.
Look.
Oh, this one. Sorry. After that.
Maybe we hands here. I think maybe we should just limit ourselves to these three.
Yeah, these last three questions.
Have a total of five.
Okay. Yeah.
Good evening, sir. This is Prasanna from the Tata Group. My question is, I keep hearing regarding this entry barrier to competition in the initial phase of the startup, and especially during the funding scene. So how does one prepare as an entrepreneur? How does one prepare or keep a tab on competition?
How do you create an entry barrier?
Yeah.
Is that your question?
No, I think you're saying there is an entry barrier. How do I get into the market in that sense? Is that
yeah.
Okay. All right.
Very similar to what my friend in the back said. I'm Navash. I work with Ticket Goose as well. You talked about three stages of entrepreneurs, which is stage one, which is young, and stage three, which is young at heart. But you said that young at heart entrepreneurs have the advantage of networking, whereas the first stage might lack at that. So how do you overcome that as an obstacle, or do we, at what point in time do we take that as an obstacle which
that networking is not helping anymore?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Last question. Oh, someone has to ask the last question. Come on. There's some hands up here. On the right. That's it. All right. No, no, please. Okay. There's a question in the back from the lady. No, from the lady there. Yes.
Madhuri, I'm doing MS in Ocean Engineering Department. My question is it always necessary to have a professional experience or working with an organization to build our own organization?
Alright.
Or if not, if it is not necessary to have a professional experience, how can an unexperienced person can start his own business or organization?
So maybe I should start with Madhuri's question here. And, you know, quite clearly, obviously, we talked about early stage entrepreneurs, and early stage can be literally early stage. I gave you the three examples of people who actually have created the three most impactful organizations of, at least certainly this high-tech world, in this century perhaps. They didn't even complete college. So there are innumerable people who today say, this is what I've cut out to do. That's what I want to do. I want a passion for it. You're learning entrepreneurship today in your engineering courses, etc., and you're surrounded in this place. You're particularly fortunate because you've got an incubator right within the IIT. And people can leverage on that and build on that and get started. So how does an early stage entrepreneur with literally no experience do it? If that's your passion, that's what somebody wants to do. Two or three things. One is, I think, right here, you are in a very fortunate situation. Can you get someone in an ecosystem which helps you in incubation? And fortunately, that's available out here. Most parts of the country don't have that. That makes it easier for someone to be able to pick it up. The second part, as you go through, is there has to be an idea around businesses. You've got to be clear, you're not to say, hey, I want to be my own person, rather than working in an organization. It has to be built around an idea. And having done that, keep in mind all that I just told you about and what is needed in order to convert a great idea, a new product, a new service, a new way of things into a successful organization. You've got to keep in mind that success really means, in a sense, converting that idea into a successful enterprise and what are the factors which go into it. Fourth, I think, and this brings me to that marketing question also here, somebody has again said, hey, how do I get started either without either networking and so on? You know, I had answered that in a way. I think you would have the confidence of saying, when you've got something new and different to offer, it doesn't mean that everybody only wants to work with a large audience. You'll be amazed at how many people are quite willing to work with something completely brand new, something which has not been tried, and say, all right, I'll be your beta customer for that as a new service. As long as you're able to build confidence that you know what you're talking about on one side, and trust is the other aspect of it. I think they must be able to see that this is somebody whom I can trust and rely on. And that comes through, you may say, obviously nothing like demonstrating kind of trust, just working with somebody over a period of time. But when you get started, I think you're still able to get that across in the way you come across and communicate with the people, indicate to them your own values of how you intend to, in effect, be there, meet their needs and requirements. I mean, it's literally go the extra mile for the customer. So, and that links up with the point of saying, okay, there's an entry barrier for competition. Of course there is an entry barrier whenever you get it. Having said that, have you got a new product, a new service, a new way of doing things? Have you looked at it? I wouldn't worry excessively about competition, except to say that look for the weaknesses. What is it that somebody doesn't like about the incumbents or the larger existing players in the market? And there'll be plenty of stuff. And how are you addressing that? There is a good book that I can suggest to you though. It's written by David Yoffe. He's a professor at Harvard. He still is on the board of Mindtree. And he's written a book called Judo Strategy, of how young startups or smaller companies can, in a sense, make the strengths, and that's the principle of judo. How do you make the strengths of the big player turn to your advantage and make it a business for that product? Then there was an issue of, I'll just go to this business update, the IT industry rob India of a lot of talent, which Arun, you raised. You know, and again this came up a little earlier when I was meeting part of the faculty here and also in the discussions, and I mentioned, you know, my alma mater is Roorkee, and I went there 1 year as Wipro to find to my own horror that literally the entire graduating class from every single discipline had been picked up, we contributed to that, by the top four IT companies in the country. So whether they were civil, metallurgical or chemical engineers, they were all going into IT at that time. And that is a time when the industry was growing at a rate of 60-70%. And there was a huge boom. It was the one industry which was giving India pride to say that we can be a global player. And of course, remuneration levels, because it was directed outwards, were at a higher level. And of course, India needs a variety of engineers. But I must tell you, I don't believe that it is the industry which robbed people of that talent. It is the fact that a variety of reasons, where I believe that given the fact that today the opportunities are all elsewhere, the talent is flowing back. That is not happening. So you are finding that as the opportunities develop, people are, in a sense, gravitating to those industries. Now, having said that, the interesting part is that in many of those industries, today, because the IT content of every industry is increasing, you could really say that it is the mechanical engineer, for example, who's done automotive, he could choose to be in the IT industry as an automotive engineer, designing automotive parts. There's a young gentleman who I spoke to today, designing aeronautics perhaps, where he went to Harvard. You don't get into the manufacturing space to say that as an engineer, you use your engineering a lot. So, to the extent that the domain knowledge becomes very important to be delivered through an IT mechanism, you could see there's a convergence of those industries, and you're not taking away from anything. Israeli is complementing the two, and it is the integration of those two skills, you may say, or two capabilities, which are actually creating higher value addition. And then there's this question of what do I do in terms of my journey as an entrepreneur? I think that's a good question, where what happens as you go along, when do you say, I pull a plug, etc. Now, you know, this question can be asked from multiple angles. I would like to look at you as saying somebody started an entrepreneurial path, and I'm not sure whether you came from it from that angle. And then you find that the path to success in the end is not looking so clear. Or maybe there's a hemorrhaging on a financial front. How far are you able to go on this journey? It could come from a different angle. I'm not sure what angle you raise this from. That a person may find that your life script has changed. I set out to do this. I've achieved this. I've gone as far as I wanted to, but it's no longer the passion in my life. I would have had a passion. So if it's the latter one, I think the answer is very simple. You must work on something you're passionate about. When you're enjoying what you do is when you're going to get success. So if what you set off with you feel you achieved a certain milestone, a roadmap, and now you want to move on to something else, and your heart tells you that. To me, I'll tell you what is the methodology I use for decision making and anything of that sort is, I believe you must do it according to your head, your heart and your gut. Your head is giving you all the pros and cons. You can write it down on a sheet of paper. And odds are that 80 to 90% of your decisions will come through clearly on that. But not this sort of decision. I'd say your day-to-day decisions, they'll come through very largely to analytical things which require, do I go with this technology or do I go with A, B or C technology? The heart is telling you what you feel is going to enjoy the most. What is it that is going to give you the greatest pleasure? What is going to make you happy? What is going to increase happiness of people around you? Give fun to all, but sort of say, hey, this is a wonderful thing for all of us to be working on. And your gut is your instinct. It is telling you, if I look back on the decision 5 years from now, would I believe that this was the right decision to take? And if they're all pulling you in the same direction, then you're more likely than not, I would say, and even then you could make a mistake of taking the right decision. So, examining it from those different dimensions are given. Now the other issue of, if a business is struggling, you're enjoying it, this is what you really wanted to do, but you're not sure about the path to success. Here, I'll go back to that same phrase that Kaval gave, that you've got to be prepared for the high highs and the low lows. There can be some failures in early stages. And if you have the wherewithal to hold on, you should not let those discourage you. That's the important thing. As long as you've got that. But if supposing the entity has run out of funds, frankly, then it's not your decision. If you're not able to get the next round, because that decision is taken by virtue of the fact that there's no, in a sense, wherewithal to continue the entity. And that's that. Hopefully one doesn't get oneself into that situation. And I think when doing it, it's important to realize, and again, one axiom in virtually any startup, I think it applies equally to us, and we may be equally guilty of it now, largely because we started with more money than perhaps most people would, is that you always tend to overestimate your business flows, the speed at which they're coming, and you'll underestimate your costs. And if you therefore discount some of the numbers which you may have used to get into raising funding, or even in your own mind you thought were achievable, visualize the scenario, and I'm not sure whether you were talking of that as your plan B. Certainly visualize, not necessarily always worst case scenarios, because then you may not be able to get started, but at least discount what you thought were realistic of the assumptions, and actually assume that they are optimistic assumptions, and you need to scale them back to make them realistic. Okay, so there are two dimensions under which I try to answer your question. I'm not sure which was your mindset and frame of mind under which you raised it.
Thank you very much, Ashok Sutta. This has been really wonderful. And thanks for all of you for being a wonderful audience. I hope this was useful to all of you as well. So thanks and good night.